This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. As we kick off this new year, our HPR news team is focused on trash. And this morning, Bill Dorman, our news director, is here to talk about a series of stories that we'll be bringing you over the next 2 weeks. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Yeah, you know, about 5 years ago, we took a look around the islands at the conditions of Opala around the islands, basically, which islands were facing filling landfills, which were doing different things about them. And so 5 years later, we went back. And the idea of what's changed. Landfills are, of course, edging further toward capacity. They do. Some choices have been made on different islands. Others are still pending. It's really a different story on each major island, and we have reporters going into more details on that. Ashley Mizuo spent a lot of time on the west side of Oahu. Casey Harlow went to Maui. Ryan Finnerty, both the east and west sides of the Big Island. And Ku'uwehi Hiraishi went to Kauai, where the county has just taken over the management of the one landfill on island in Kekaha. Noe Tanigawa talked with some of the zero waste folks, others who've looked at other island communities dealing with trash. And while it's true that each island has its different situations, different challenges, there are some shared challenges as well. And a big part of that is recycling. 5 years ago, even 3 years ago, China was a huge market for recycled material all over the world, metal, glass, plastic, everything. That changed its policy. It was 2 years ago this month that it stopped taking plastics and a lot of other material as well. Up to that point, China had taken roughly half of the world's recycled material. I mean, you think
that's
about
astounding.
It. Isn't that astounding? And basically, it got shut down. And so you had these ripple effects that stretched all around the world, and including to here in Hawaii. And so for us, on each island, there used to be a business, some money to be made, contracting with the counties to take the recyclable material, ship it to Asia. But after China announced its policy changes, other Asian countries, Malaysia, Indonesia, Philippines, they changed their policies as well. So they are much more selective now about what they will take as recycled material. Greg Goodale is the chief of the Solid Waste Division of Hawaii County's Department of Environmental Management, and he talked with Ryan Finnerty about the impact of this shift.
Primarily, it's the change in the global recycling markets that a lot of the people that are traditional buyers of these materials just aren't taking the materials, or either have a glut, meaning they just have too much of a lot of these items, or they want materials that are far cleaner than what are coming in by a lot of the programs that are selling these materials to them. In our case, you know, instead of actually buying the materials from our contractor was having to pay a lot of money to these guys just to essentially take the material. So it was a big loss for them.
Yeah, so you're not only removing a financial inducement for recycling, but from a business perspective, as you said, it turns a modest profit into a certain loss. And that idea of readjusting to assumptions that people make. That's a theme with a lot of government policies, but certainly in terms of dealing with waste, that's true around the islands, and you're seeing that in different ways on different islands.
Yeah, I think I recall doing an interview with a recycler in my neighborhood, and he said that he was having to send his containers to Vietnam.
Yeah. And again, even these countries further down that chain of development are starting to say, well, wait a minute, this is not sort of a race to the bottom of we don't want to take this as well. So that idea of pushback from different countries is something that's grown. And that's not the only change. Since, you know, you take the clock back 5 years, you know, hands up for listeners out there who got something from Amazon over the last couple of months. You know, that's really changed the world in terms of the cardboard boxes alone. But also think about this, the packaging inside those Amazon boxes. How many little plastic pillows and sort of single-use items are in there? You know, trash basically is one of those items that can sometimes go under the radar. People take it for granted that it's going to be, it's like flipping on the light switch and the power is going to come on. You dump out the trash and it's going to go away and it's going to go somewhere and it's going to be fine. It's like infrastructure maintenance. It's kind of a hidden issue for a lot of people until it's not. And it is a form of infrastructure issue. It's, and just like climate change now is part of various conversations from development to economic change, trash can go in the same category. So when you talk about things, for example, another change from 5 years ago, about 5 years of visitor arrival records.
Yes. Yeah,
2014, 8.3 million visitors, right? That was a record. Now for 2019, expected to break 10 million. And I'm not dumping on the tourism and hospitality industry here. I'm just saying that that is something to absorb. And just as there are impacts in other areas of the community, there are impacts on generation of trash.
Yeah, it's interesting because I know I've been noticing garbage on my street and was just wondering, gosh, why is there all this rubbish out there? And then come to find out these folks might be, using their units in, as vacation rentals. So they've got more trash than you normally see.
And that's that idea of that it is a thread to a lot of other stories is something that within this series, different reporters getting a chance to get into some deeper conversations about this. And it really touches also on ways of thinking about this. So, you know, on Oahu, it's sort of too easy to say, oh, well, that'll just go to H power. That's fine. You know, the reduction in the waste stream is something, and you're seeing this, the plastic bag ban, other policy initiatives have had an effect on this, but it really also touches on individual behavior. A lot more to come over the next couple of weeks on this, but some interesting story threads.
Okay. All right. We'll look forward to it. We've been talking with Bill Dorman, HPR's news director, about trash and recycling stories that you will be hearing about over the next 2 weeks. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. If you spent any time around Diamond Head and its surrounding areas on the island of Oahu, then you probably know about Fort Ruger. The fort itself shares a name with the neighborhood it resides, nestled between Kaimuki and Kahala. Built in 1906, Fort Ruger was the first coastal fortification built by the United States Army on the island of Oahu. While little of the original structures remain today, in its heyday, Fort Ruger was the site of Battery Harlow, along with its imposing 12-inch mortars. The fort's prominent position atop Diamond Head's peak made it an ideal location from which its garrison could observe the open sea. Only a handful of the original structures remain today, including a handful of gateposts, guardhouses, and bunkers, many of which can be seen on the hike up to Diamond Head. Long since decommissioned, the site nowadays is home to exercising joggers and hikers rather than actual military exercise, although the Coast Guard occasionally uses the old fort for training. Now for today's backyard quiz, can you tell us who Fort Ruger is named after? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the realtors and staff of Locations, proudly supporting HPR's commitment to sharing stories of Hawaii's people and places. Locations, welcome home.
With the new year, we are rebranding a segment on our show. The Hawaii Forest and Garden segment, which we launched a year ago, will take a broader view. Mauka Makai is more in keeping with Hawaiian culture and taking care of the land. Malama aina, malama the sea. Today, we focus in on rubbish trees. It's a complaint you commonly hear about. It's a pet peeve for some homeowners who don't like having to clean up after a messy tree that drops seeds, leaves, and fruit. The mess can be a liability and just makes for more work, and who needs that? Professor Ken Leonhardt is a professor of horticulture at the University of Hawaii, and he's been working to provide sterile trees for landscapers.
There are a lot of rubbish trees, trees that are prolific seed producers or prolific producers of seed pods. Leguminous trees are probably the biggest culprits. They produce hundreds or thousands sometimes of large seed pods. And what comes to mind would be the Royal Poinciana tree. It's a spectacular tree, but it can produce, a good-sized tree can produce over 1,000 seed pods, and sometimes they're 2 feet long. And you can't mow your lawn until you rake all those up. You could fill a pickup truck full of the seed pods from those. So we have created a seedless one, or a sterile one that is almost completely seedless. And there's a lot of others. There's the African tulip tree, which is not so much of a litter problem as it is an invasive species problem. It's all over the forest, and not so much the dry forest, but wherever there's a little bit of moisture, you'll find it, and it produces thousands of seeds. They're windblown, so they can travel long distances, and landscapers continue to use the plant because they say, well, there's no really good substitute, and it's quite attractive, and it fits in parking lot spaces and for street trees, and we haven't been able to propagate them as readily as we want, but we're working on that. One that I recently identified as sterile, four plants actually, is the octopus tree. Been working with that one for maybe about 6 or 7 years now, and finally we've come up with four different clones that flower, but the flowers immediately drop off. They have not produced any seed at all. And that plant is another one that's extremely invasive and a litter problem and also a bit of a hazard. The fruits are wet and you can slip on them. If they fall on a sidewalk and you happen to step into a bunch of those fruits, you can slip.
So you see those everywhere, though.
They are everywhere, and they stain anything they touch. You know, they've got some purple, blackish kind of pigment in it. They'll stain your clothes. They stain sidewalks. They stain, anyway. So a seedless one would be quite desirable, and I've now identified four, and probably I probably have more, but they haven't flowered yet. So you can't determine if they're sterile or not until they flower.
I see.
Yeah. So we have a lot of things that we anticipate sterility based on the techniques that we've used to manipulate the chromosomes or the crosses that we've made in the case of hybrids, but we have to wait till they flower. This spring and summer is going to be very exciting for me for shower trees. Shower trees, as you know, they're dependent on the species or the hybrid. They can produce enormous amounts of seed pods. I have 52 plants at the University of Hawaii Experiment Station in Waimanalo that are progeny of a three-species cross, and we have expectations of a high degree of sterility. We've identified, well, we haven't counted the chromosomes, but we've measured the DNA or quantified the DNA, and it's highly variable in that entire population. And that lends itself to a high degree of sterility. But so, these haven't flowered yet, so.
So you don't know.
Yeah, but I will. And probably beginning about May, June, they should start flowering. Two of them flowered last year, and they were both sterile. And I'm expecting probably 35 to 40 of them to flower this year.
Okay, now so. I just went on a tree tour at Kapi'olani Park, and the city urban forestry folks shared that you shared some seedlings with them, and so they'll plant some trees to figure out, you know, are these sterile or not?
Yeah, I gave them several hundred plants of many different species. I just had way too many. Stan Oka, the person in charge of the urban forestry division, has places to plant them. Right now, I think they're all out at Mililani, but he's going to find places, and he's going to identify them individually and give me a map or at least some location information so I can keep track of them.
Right, so that would be a help to the forestry division.
It's a help to them, perhaps, if they are sterile, and a big help to my research because I need more space to grow things.
Okay, and talk about the process, because you talked about chromosomes and clones, and you know, there folks are worried about GMO. So explain to people what you're doing.
Okay. These plants are not products of GMO. I'm just accelerating a process that's actually kind of natural. Well, it is a natural process. There are a number of species of plants that where periodically they will just have chromosome doubling, and that can be selected as a new variety if it shows important or useful characteristics. So I accelerate that process by using either the alkaloid colchicine or another what's called a mitotic poison, or rhizolin. And it interferes using these agents on a meristem, or a very young bud of a plant where cell division is occurring rapidly. It interferes with part of that a doubling. It's part of that process. Okay, let me put it this way: when growth takes place, growth takes place as a result of cell division and cell multiplication. Chromosomes line up in the cell. They divide. They produce two daughter cells with the same number of chromosomes. Under the influence of a rhizolin or colchicine, the chromosome numbers double, but they don't separate into two daughter cells. So if you started with a plant that had a cell that had 20 chromosomes, you would normally end up with two daughter cells, each with 20 chromosomes. In this case, you end up with a daughter cell of 40 chromosomes. And it'll stay that way, and if it continues to multiply, all the cells from that particular doubled cell will have 40 chromosomes. That's called a tetraploid, four sets of chromosomes. That sometimes leads to sterility. It has, in the case of the shower trees, 100% sterility. Or if the plants are fertile as tetraploids, you can cross them with diploids, with plants with two sets of chromosomes. The progeny will have three sets of chromosomes, and that's almost always sterile. That's how seedless watermelons are made. They cross tetraploids with diploids, they get triploids,
and
it's
voila.
Sterile.
Yeah.
bananas also. You don't see seeds in bananas because they're natural occurring triploids. They've been selected by humans. There are diploid bananas in their native habitats, and they are full of seeds.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, I know this topic is interesting to some just because, you know, there's a big push to plant all these trees to offset carbon, offset the pollution. And when you start to think about and start to identify, you know, the street trees, what's out there, and you want to get people to plant trees, but that's the biggest complaint. I don't want a rubbish tree in front of my house. You know, the homeowner isn't going to buy into this idea if he's got to rake up pods, you know, whether they're from mahogany trees or monkey pods.
Mm-hmm. Monkey pods, interesting one. We have sterile monkey pods. Although I've got a few plants that are sterile, but they produce a seed pod that doesn't have any seeds in it. It's about the size of a Chinese flat pea, but there's no seeds and there's no resin in it. So it's not going to stick to your slippers like typical monkey pod fruits do. And we've also created, I think I have about 10 triploid monkey pod trees, and I expect those to be even a higher degree of sterility and not produce any fruits at all.
We just did a segment on some special grass on the Big Island, Vetiver grass, I think it's called.
It's a clumping grass, so it doesn't spread readily. It's got really deep root systems, so it's good for erosion management. It produces a flower head, but doesn't set seed. So it's really a wonderful plant.
And you have a bag full of goodies. You have this giant seed pod, which is like a yardstick. What is this?
This is a species of shower tree.
Oh, my goodness.
The genus is Cassia. All shower trees are in the genus Cassia. And this is Cassia grandis. It's about a meter long. And
wow.
I never weighed it, but it's probably half a pound
or
more.
Wow, it can do some serious damage if it lands on your head.
Yeah, or on the hood of your car. And that's the very reason why this plant isn't used in landscapes. It's a very, very nice tree. It's a nice pink flowers. It's got a long flowering season. But you just wouldn't use it in landscapes for this reason.
It's a weapon.
So we created a sterile one.
I see.
I think four clones of this that are sterile. This is Cassia bakeriana. Feel it. It's got a nice texture.
Fluffy.
Yeah.
Furry.
Yeah, it's very tactile.
Like suede almost.
But the reason it's not used.
Oh, it's stinky.
Yeah. Ugh. The fruits stink. The flowers don't have any odor at all. In fact, mm-hmm. the flowers have a kind of a faint, pleasant, sweet smell to them.
But this is like PU.
I know. The fruit is really stinky. So that's why it's not used much. It's occasionally used in areas where you don't get foot traffic near the tree. But it'll produce one mature plant can produce more than 1,000 of these fruits.
Wow.
And they don't stink until they're broken. That's why I handed you the broken one.
Okay.
this one doesn't smell at all. But when you break it, the resin inside that encloses the seeds, it reeks. So we have sterile forms of this.
Okay, yeah. Would not want that in my yard. Most definitely.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else just about this research and just what is it that excites you about being able to do this?
Do you remember a tree that was grown? It was called vertical willy willy or tall willy willy. It's not so much grown as a landscape plant, but it was used by every farmer as a windbreak plant. They would get very tall, 20, 25 feet tall, and they were easy to propagate, and it was everybody's favorite windbreak plant. There were thousands and thousands, maybe millions, grown. And then in 2005, a wasp came in from Africa, western part of Africa, called the Erythrina gall wasp, and within about 3 or 4 years, it just completely decimated the entire population of Erythrina variegata. And also, it heavily damaged and reduced the numbers of our only native willy willy, which is Erythrina sandwichensis. We treated the Erythrina variegata, the vertical form, and we made some polyploid plants with multiple sets of chromosomes. And for reasons that we still don't understand, but we're going to get a graduate student working on it, it's resistant to the gall wasp. So I'm very hopeful that we will be able to reintroduce that vertical growing willy willy plant within a couple of years as a gall wasp tolerant variety. We have 3 clones for sure that are totally resistant to the gall wasp, and we're still looking at some others that we haven't really exposed them yet to the gall wasp because they're too young.
And what about our natives then?
The natives, we have 5 plants of the Erythrina sandwichensis, which is the native willy willy, that have a very high level of tolerance to the gall wasp.
So maybe we can bring those back?
Yeah, I'm hopeful.
Leonhardt says his research is very rewarding and he absolutely loves going to work every day. Our online news partner, Honolulu Civil Beat, is featuring a story about how the threat of cyber spies is actually boosting our economy. Political and opinion editor Chad Blair joins us live. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
So you have a story by Stuart Yurton about this.
Yeah, and he can't be here today, and I know he would love to speak with you, Catherine, about this story, but I'm hoping I can do it justice. I was actually genuinely surprised by the idea that Hawaii might actually have an opportunity to develop cyber technology and provide high-paying jobs to folks growing up here. As we always know, we have the highest cost of living overall. Folks flee to the mainland for good-paying jobs. And yet Stewart, by focusing on this facility in Wahiawa, as it turns out, an NSA facility, says there's already 3,500 people working this command. And NSA, of course, stands for National Security Agency. And this is a potential to recruit young folks here through academia, through our schools, to get jobs. Frankly, hacking for the government is essentially what you'd be doing.
Well, you know, I happened to catch the news last night, and, you know, there's a lot of concern about threats with the situation with Iran. And they said, you know, there's also the potential for cyber threats.
Yeah, there really are. And what Stewart did is he went out to this facility, and it's so secure, of course. You can't take photos. You can't bring your cell phone in there. You have to show your passport. But what this particular NSA facility, one of 4 in the country, is focused on is the area of the Pacific and greater region around us. And, of course, probably 4 or 5 of the top biggest threats in national security are in this area. Russia, I should say potential threats, Russia, China, North Korea, and extremist organizations. And so that's why it's so important that these cyber tech folks, these cyber spies, looking at things like wireless phones, they're tapping into satellites, they're tapping into the internet, try and come up with information to then sift through and see what's going on. How can we defend the nation against these threats?
Well, I'm so jealous that Stewart got to go up to this facility, because you're, I think, only one of a couple of news organizations that have been allowed up there.
Right, only three total, only one from Hawaii. And by the way, even though we're talking about a secret organization, it is part of the government. And you can see the facility from the outside. It is in Wahiawa. There's actually a photo on our webpage of the facility with a rainbow, as it turns out, pointing toward it. It's named after someone fairly well known, at least for those who follow World War II history, the Navy captain who helped decipher the enemy codes to ambush the Japanese fleet at Midway. But the NSA facility also has a more, how shall we say it, notorious reputation for those who remember back to 2013, Edward Snowden. He was a civilian contractor there. That's right, Edward Snowden, living in Hawaii. And as we all know, he leaked classified documents, took those thumb drives, if I remember correctly, and headed to Hong Kong, and now he's in Russia. And of course, what he did was expose the extensive nature of the NSA's spying, particularly keeping records of American cell phones.
And talk about the efforts that Senator Donovan de la Cruz has got going.
Well, here's another thing that was a surprise to me. There is, in fact, a Mililani tech park in Mililani. I did know about that. It's about 150 acres, and it's coordinated by the Hawaii Tech Development Corporation. Donovan de la Cruz, the state senator, the Ways and Means chair, that is his district, and he has been long trying to leverage high-tech, cyber-tech into well-paying jobs to tie it in to bringing other organizations to work here and offer more jobs. What sets us apart, meaning Hawaii, from Georgia, Texas, and Colorado, where the other centers are located for the NSA, is they have a whole infrastructure and ecosystem around them that has actually resulted in a lot of jobs, thousands of jobs in this case. Well, de la Cruz thinks that can be done here. And to do that, however, you have to leverage, you have to bring in capital, and really you got to have the government, academia, and the industry itself working together. But de la Cruz thinks this is a real potential to bring high-tech jobs, more of them, to the state.
Right, but there's got to be concerted effort, so everybody's got to be on the same page.
Yeah, there's got to be effort. There's got to be will. It is interesting, though. It's already happening in some local high schools, including at Lelehua, which is where Senator de la Cruz went to school. That's in the Wahiawa area. There's actually a photo on our story showing young high schoolers looking at a computer screen and working on a cyber tech technology. And you need to get them young, though. I mean, talk about STEM research. Talk about STEM jobs. This is a real potential. But he says we really need to instill it as something very long term over the broad spectrum in order to make these jobs materialize.
Yeah, well, I know when I was a kid, I always wanted to be a spy. So, yeah, if we can get
might
those
have missed your calling, Catherine.
Yeah, I know. But get those young minds out there. Get them started early. Thanks so much, Chad.
You're welcome.
That was political and opinion editor Chad Blair with today's Reality Check. To read Stuart Yurton's story, go to sybilbeat.org.
Coming Saturday, January 25th, Hawaii Opera Theater brings a collection of operettas, musical theater, and more, all by American composers, to the intimate and acoustically rich HPR Atherton Studio. Experience song on stage in a whole new way. Station members enjoy discounted pricing. Get your tickets now at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Water conservation is one of the most pressing issues farmers in Hawaii have to contend with today. But how can algorithms and spreadsheets help those in Hawaii's agricultural sectors be better stewards of our most precious resource? Well, that's a question that a joint research team from the University of Hawaii at Manoa looks to help answer. The U.S. Department of Agriculture recently funded the team with nearly $1 million in grants as they continue to bridge the gap between hard science and soft soil. Jonathan Dienick is with the College of Tropical Agriculture and Human Resources. He spoke with the Conversation's Harrison Patino about where algorithms meet agriculture.
This work started actually in 2013 through a partnership between myself and Dr. Michael Kahn, University of California Cooperative Extension, Monterey County, who over the last eight or nine years has developed a really nifty web-based irrigation scheduling tool. And so I first began interacting with him back in 2013, and we wanted to work with him to adapt that technology for our farms here in Hawaii. And so Dr. Bateni from the College of Engineering Water Resources Research Center is an ecohydrologist, and he approached me, and so we wrote our first NRCS CIG grant funded in 2014. And so those were the three main partners, but we have our collaborators in Guam at the University of Guam and College of American Samoa, and so we have project sites there as well. With the first grant from the CIG program, we were able to calibrate the CropManage software. That's the software that my colleague in California has developed to Hawaii-specific conditions. Our types of crops, our environment, and we've set up a network of automated weather stations. That's the real important facet of this research. And we've begun our validation side-by-side trials to see, are we able to help growers better match water delivery to water needs of their crops.
You're trying to help solve some of the most pressing issues facing farmers today. What are some of those issues?
Globally, about 70% of the water, freshwater resources are used for agriculture. And without irrigation, we'd be in big trouble. For Hawaii, for example, our best farmlands, our most highly productive farmlands are in the dry sides of the islands. That's where the most fertile soils are and the least disease pressure. So without irrigation, they can't grow their crops. But we have a limited water resource. You know, water is valuable, and we need to make sure that farmers are delivering that water efficiently, economically, and, you know, not wasting it. So water is one of our most valuable resources, and helping farmers use it wisely is pretty important.
So for the laymen of water conservation like me, could you break down the connection, or rather bridge the gap between what your work is doing versus the tangibles of how that's helping farmers conserve water?
Farmers are pretty good at delivering water. I mean, they know their farms, they know their environment, but they tend to, like all of us in, for insurance, they may over-apply water. And that's understandable because under-applying will reduce yields, and that's an economic loss to them. Over-application, though, has some critical issues in that, first, you're using a very valuable resource not wisely, and secondly, excess water removes fertilizer from the root zone, and it ends up in our aquifers, which are connected to the ocean. So there's a direct potential for contamination of our coastal lands. Our work already has shown in our preliminary side-by-side trials at 20 to 40% reduction in water use, irrigation, with no effect on yield.
What are some of the implications for Hawaii farmers if issues like this aren't faced?
How much water do we have? You know, that's another question. How much fresh water do we have? I know there's a big effort at the University of Hawaii and the School of Ocean and Earth Science Technology trying to better quantify the amount of water available to us. So, you know, it's a limited resource. And if we don't use it wisely, we'll face the consequences.
The use of water has really become a hot-button issue in Hawaii lately. Do you see your work as sort of contributing to the larger consciousness of being stewards of our natural resources?
It's fundamentally that. Good stewards use resources wisely and protect it for future generations. So this work, the fundamental target is to how do we help a farmer grow good crops so that we produce locally available healthy food, but at the same time conserve and protect water resources. And it's a delicate balance.
There's a lot of different hands going into this work. There's your college and there's other colleges that you're working with. How do you think the different members and organizations at play here kind of complement each other and work off of each other?
You know, Dr. Bateni is the principal investigator on the grants, and he's a numerical modeler, well-trained in mathematics and in modeling water systems, especially evapotranspiration. And so he comes from a very theoretical standpoint, and so his role is very critical here because the better models we can develop to address the complex natural phenomena, the better off we are. Myself, I work a lot with extension agents. We're the interface with the farmer. So we make sure that the trials and the data collection at the field level don't interfere with farmers and that they can see the value of how we're doing this. This new grant has also brought in people from the University of Nebraska who are also highly skilled, trained numerical modelers developing these computer-based programs that help to integrate the different facets. And then we have our partners in Guam and Saipan.
What are some of the goals you hope to achieve now that you've got this new slew of funding?
This next phase is really looking at the uncertainty of how we... An important part of irrigation scheduling is to be able to predict evapotranspiration, or how much water the plant will use into the future, and also predict rainfall in the future, because that's how you get the schedule, the recommendation. You look at your current water use up to the point, the stage of growth of the plant, and then what it's going to need into the future. This project now is looking at quite sophisticated mathematical models to better predict future evapotranspiration and future rainfall, which is one of the big missing pieces to get that recommendation to better match what the plant is going to see into the future.
Could you break down that term evapotranspiration? Because I think a lot of people might not understand that.
Okay, so plants are growing in soil and they use water from the soil, okay, and they transpire that water to the atmosphere. There's also water being lost from the soil due to the energy of the sun, just evaporating that from the soil surface. Evapotranspiration combines those two processes, loss of water from the soil directly due to sunlight and energy, and the transmission of water through the plant by the plant. And so it's one of the key critical components in being able to develop an irrigation recommendation, is how much water is that plant going to be using at any given time.
I feel like high mathematical concepts can really scare a lot of people. So taking that, translating it, and turning it into a real-world application, I think, is really important for an issue like this. Long-term, are there any sort of habits you want to encourage in farmers? Is there a long-term goal for what you're trying to get people to see out of water conservation 5-10 years from now?
I see it as a true team. The farmer, the scientist, the extension agent, all working together to, one, grow healthy food for our local people, and at the same time, protect our resources. And so the beauty of this is that it has a very practical part. So we're constantly interacting with farmers. And through that interaction, they're asking questions, we're asking questions, there's a free flow of information, we're both learning things, we adapt our tools so that it doesn't interfere or, you know, have them, cause them too much humbug, you know, as a simple term. So I think it's we try to work both ways here. And the ultimate goal is to keep farming profitable and ecological, you know, so that it makes sense and it doesn't harm the natural environment. It enhances it.
A more sustainable model without upending people's livelihoods.
Exactly. We want farmers to be good farmers. And if we're successful here, farmers will continue farming and they'll be better farmers because they'll make more money. They have to pay for this water. So and Michael has shown in California, Dr. Khan has shown 20 to 40% reduction in water use without affecting yield. So that's an increased profit to the farmer. Ultimately, that's where we're going. We're 8 years behind the UC system because they started 10 years or so ago. But the partnership is moving quite nicely.
That was Jonathan Dienick, a professor with the College of Tropical Agriculture and Human Resources. He was talking with the Conversation's Harrison Patino. Dienick is part of a multi-departmental team at UH Manoa that was recently the recipient of a $900,000 grant by the USDA. Their work looks to combine laboratory mathematics and real-world applications to help Hawaii's farmers better conserve the island's scarce clean water resources. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. On today's Stargazer, astronomer Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence discuss changes in the night sky that affect scientists' ability to observe faint objects in the heavens.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet and also things we can try and spot in our dark island skies. As usual, turning to the expertise of astronomer Christopher Phillips, we've got him on the line right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's in store this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. This week's Stargazer, Saturn can be found in the west after sunset and will be there until it sets just after 8 p.m. The moon is approaching full this week, and as such, stargazing for those faint objects in the heavens will be very challenging indeed.
Now, one of those things in the heavens is quite faint, actually. It's a star, and it's mysteriously fading out.
Indeed. The super red giant star Betelgeuse, known as Kaluakoko here in Hawaii, is the second brightest star in the constellation of Orion. And up until recently, with the exception of minor variability, its brightness was considered more or less constant. However, Kaluakoko is misbehaving, and its brightness appears to be fading, and it is now the faintest it has been for 100 years.
This one, as I remember, is going to be a supernova, so is this a precursor to that?
As exciting as that prospect may be, it's highly unlikely that Kaluakoko is going to explode anytime soon. It probably has a million years, give or take a few hundred thousand, left before it blows.
And what do you think is making the thing dim?
Well, when a star undergoes a change in brightness, it's usually the result of some intrinsic astrophysical process within the star itself. It could be that this fading brightness is the result of variations in the atmosphere of the star. A good way to visualize this would be a bowl of tomato soup that has been on the stove for too long.
And so you're saying the star is bubbling?
Indeed. Stars are superheated balls of gas, and their interiors are sort of like a nuclear soup. They are turbulent and energetic, and their atmospheres are filled with hot and cool material that can cause changes in brightness of the star.
And if that thing does a supernova, which means it explodes, right?
A big explosion. But luckily for us here on the Earth, there is no danger at all. In fact, we may be treated to an incredible celestial fireworks display, so bright that the star may be visible during the day.
And you're thinking that's 100 years from now or something?
100,000 years from now.
Right, okay. Well, we'll be looking forward to that. Let me put a little note in my calendar about that. Christopher Phillips, another fun report on something we're not going to be experiencing, but someone in the future might, and we appreciate it. Thank you.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week on Stargazer, which you can find at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, architects for the Natural Energy Laboratory of Hawaii Authority's Hawaii Gateway Energy Center in Kailua Kona. FerraroChoi.com.
In today's backyard quiz, we look at the history behind Fort Ruger, both the neighborhood and the fort itself. Built in 1906 as a coastal U.S. Army fortification for the purpose of defending Honolulu's vast harbor, Fort Ruger was among the most impressive military installations on Oahu during its time. Little of the original fortifications stand today, although passerbyers can find the ruins of old guardhouses and gateposts along the street just across from Kapi'olani Community College. Today, the name Fort Ruger has come to mean not only the decommissioned fort itself, but the historic district along Diamond Head Road surrounding it, which was established in 1911. Built in Hawaii's territorial days shortly after the annexation of the islands, Fort Ruger was initially called the Diamond Head Reservation, but would later be renamed in honor of Thomas H. Ruger, a general who fought for the Union during the Civil War. And that was the answer we were looking for, but we have no winners today. If you have an idea for a backyard quiz, please send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Forbes recently named Rafe Gaspar Asaoka to its 30 Under 30 list of venture capitalists for 2020, recognizing the best young investors in the country. Gaspar Asaoka is a 2009 graduate of Iolani School, and he has a bachelor's and master's degree in electrical engineering. He joined Kanan Partners in 2015 and rose to partner, the youngest in the firm's history. Kanan invests in early-stage technology and healthcare companies. He currently lives in the Bay Area, but he was home for the holidays and spoke with our producer, Jason Ubai. He tells us about his day-to-day as a venture capitalist.
The day-to-day as a VC, at least my day-to-day, is pretty variable. I'd say I like to break it up in kind of percentages of my time spent at work. So I think about 30 to 40% of my time is spent investing, meeting new companies and meeting them as potential new investments. So that's taking your first meeting, whether it's on the phone or over lunch or an in-person meeting. There's about the other 30 to 40% is spent doing diligence on companies. So think about it as like a funnel. We meet hundreds of companies a year. We end up investing in a handful of them. So in between that stage, between the time we meet them and the time we invest, there's a diligence process where we're evaluating whether or not they're a good fit for us, whether or not we're a good fit for them, whether or not it's a company that we want to work with and that wants to work with us. So that's about 30 to 40% of my time. And then the last 20 to 30% is spent working with the portfolio company. So that's companies that we've invested in, that we sit on the board of, that we're helping to help grow over time. And so that's everything from board meetings to going over to their offices and helping them hire, think through strategy, et cetera.
What kind of companies are you working with right now? I think I saw that your main clients are like on the cutting edge of artificial intelligence.
Yeah, so I'll start broad and then kind of zoom in. So broadly, Kane & Partners is an early stage venture capital fund. So that means we invest in early stage companies. Seed Series A, Series B is sort of the titles that they have at that time, meaning they're from inception to about 2 to 3 years old at the oldest. And we're usually the first sort of institutional capital that will come in and invest in the company. So prior to that, they'll have raised maybe some grant money or maybe some money from angels or friends and family to help run the business. And then we're the first sort of larger check that comes in from the institutional capital side. And then we invest broadly. Kanan as a firm invests in both tech and healthcare. So we invest in healthcare companies, mostly biopharm, new drug development type companies, some med devices. It's a separate team that looks at that, just given the complexity and on that side. And then within tech, it's everything across the board. So we have a bunch of investors at the firm that spend time in consumer. So things like consumer marketplaces like Instacart to fintech companies to, enterprise software. And then I spend a lot of my time in what we sort of call frontier tech. And that's areas like AI, machine learning, robotics, autonomous vehicles, space tech, all the really crazy stuff.
I wanted to step back, got a degree in electrical engineering. I mean, how did you move from that to what you're doing today? Because I mean, I think when most people think, you major in electrical engineering, it's kind of a nuts and bolts type of job,
right?
Or that's what you're preparing for. So how did you get into venture capital?
It was a little by accident in some ways. I think when I was doing engineering, and especially when I was in grad school, I think there are two things that I took away from my engineering degree. One, I really liked engineering, not necessarily because I enjoyed circuit design or I enjoyed signal processing, but I enjoyed the problem-solving aspect of what I was learning. So how to take this abstract problem of, how do you create something, and how do you distill it down into the logical flows to get from point A to point B? So how do you build a circuit that does et cetera, X, Y, and Z? How do you take that from the abstract layers at the very top of a problem all the way to like building and designing something? And I think that problem-solving aspect was very interesting to me, not necessarily the fact that it was four circuits or that it was four signal processing. And then the second thing I learned is, especially when I was in grad school, I was going down a very, very narrow path. I was actually pursuing my PhD in electrical engineering at the time, and you're becoming very specialized in one thing. And just from my own personality standpoint, I'd rather be a layer up, which is more like big picture stuff, and I'd rather see how this correlates to that, which then affects this, rather than just go down a very, very, very narrow but specific path of electrical engineering. So for me, I think the PhD route just wasn't the right fit.
Yep.
So I took a step back and figured out what I wanted to do next. Maybe the anti-PhD in a lot of ways is consulting. So you go and you jump across into different projects and you work on something for a few months, then you jump to another thing. And so I did consulting right after I left grad school. And from there, I was trying to figure out what to do next after a year or so in consulting. And the thing that I liked about venture capital is it combined the sort of three things that I was looking for. One, it combined, I was getting back into tech in a deep way. So like I enjoyed, I liked tech. That's why I was in engineering. Consulting had aspects of that, but it wasn't fully immersed in it. Two, I enjoyed investing. So when I said I did a stint in Chicago, I worked at an options trading firm and learned a little bit on the investing side. Really enjoyed that. And then the third thing was it was, like I said, it was higher level. Like it was deeper. It wasn't as deep as just doing your PhD. When I worked with companies and got to invest in companies, it's working across all facets of the business, right? Not just the technology and engineering side, but it's across the business model, across where the market is headed. And I got to think at sort of a little bit of a higher level. And so venture kind of fit all the things I was looking for. Bay Area is a good place to do it. Yeah. So sort of through some networking, ended up at Canaan.
Is there anything that you, growing up here and going to Iolani, that helps you with your career today?
Yeah, there's quite a few things. I think the biggest thing for me is, being in the Bay Area now for 7 years, I think it's easy to kind of get tunnel vision and go down and see, yeah, like there's, self-driving cars on the road, or there's the latest on-demand delivery app or something that's spun up in the Bay Area. And it's easy to get tunnel vision to, like, that's the way life is generally, right? Like, of course there's an app that can get you something from, that can get me from point A to point B in 2 seconds. And of course, if I just ordered online, it should be delivered in an hour. And I think the thing I like about having, growing up in Hawaii and at least having the perspective from Hawaii, is that that's not how the rest of the world always is, right? That's not, technology is one aspect of the economy and the society, but it's not everything. Whereas I think in the Bay Area, we're definitely over-indexed on tech and sort of innovation and moving faster. Whereas back in, when I think about my perspective from Hawaii, and especially like my parents and my family that's all still here, it's helpful when I'm meeting these companies and they're pitching these new innovations, for me to think, like, would my sister use this? Would my dad and mom use this service or this product? Like, is this something that they would like as well, right? So I think that itself has been a really good, really helpful perspective to have growing up in Hawaii.
That was Rafe Gaspar Asaoka of Canaan Partners. He is the third Iolani School graduate to be recognized on a Forbes 30 Under 30 list since 2018. And you know, we're out of time, but up tomorrow, we take a closer look at the state of Apala here on Oahu, the back and forth on where we bury our trash. If you want to listen back to today's show, or if you want to find a past one, look under HPR News and Talk on the Conversation page. I'm Catherine Cruz.